He refused to say any more until they'd descended a high-speed lift that dropped them into the belly of the enormous building. Nondescript, soothing music wafted from speakers. Straker stoically held his impatience in check. It seemed Don had one final act in his play before returning him to Republic space. The fastest way home was to put up with it. The background music swelled, but remained a dreamy, relaxing sort as the lift doors opened, and they debouched onto a balcony overlooking another factory floor. This one differed from the halls of the underworld in that it was brightly and pleasantly lit. Green flowering plants streamed from suspended pots and from the walls. Their pleasing scents filled the air. On the whole, it seemed an environment tailor-made for people to relax, like a spa. Humans of all sorts, from huge red Bortoks to the short, fat pigmen and everything in between, filed through maze-like walls at one end. Each wore a simple white robe, like a sheet with a hole cut in the center and dropped over their heads. Sprays of mist or gas fell intermittently among them, and they all moved as if enthralled, hypnotized zombies. When they reached the end of their mazes, one at a time they were led without protest by ant-like opter workers to tables where they were directed to lie down. A mask with a feeder hose was placed over each face, and they closed their eyes. Then, the cutting started. Robotic surgical arms used lasers to slice the people into pieces quickly and efficiently. Straker's gorge rose as soon as he realized what was happening, and he struggled not to vomit. He'd seen plenty of blood and death. He'd watched as butchers dismembered Melgar's people for meat and fur. But this seemed somehow worse, with its cheerful atmosphere and its clinical, ruthless processing. There was little blood, and each part was delicately removed and immediately placed in cryogenic receptacles that dripped condensed vapor downward before they quickly closed. First, the fingers or sometimes whole hands and arms were amputated. Then, the torso was sliced open and the skin was pulled back with precision. Mechanical tentacles rapidly removed each organ and put it into their chill containers. When there was nothing left of the body cavity, the ribs, muscles, and spine was then separated. And finally, the parts of the head, eyes, ears, jaw, skull, everything. No more than 2 minutes passed from the placing of the mask to the complete disappearance of every trace of one human's existence. It was a scrapyard, a recycling facility, an annihilation machine. It made a human being into nothing. Every time it did, the robotic cart containing the receptacles drove off through a door on quiet rubber wheels. "This is the end of many on Terra Nova," Don said. "Young or old, genius or stupid, cruel or kind. If they displease the queens or break the rules or get on the wrong side of the controllers or anyone else with authority, or simply get too old, vivisection is their fate." Straker rubbed his eyes. "This is what you wanted me to see. It's stomach-churning. This whole planet is one big house of horrors, even if parts of it seem pleasant. And what makes it that way? What's the root cause? You tell me." "No, Derek. I've laid it out for you. You instinctively recognized it in your own society. Societies, I should say. Since you've seen several firsthand. You fought against it, and for its opposite. They even gave you a title that exemplifies your role, a role you were meant to play. Come on, Derek, put it together." Straker rubbed his jaw, forcing himself to look at the clinical holocaust below. He thought about everything he'd seen since the Battle of Corinth, the mutuality, the war, Saxon, the Ruxans, the hundred worlds from the outside, and about the Opters and Terra Nova. Tyranny, he finally said. It's all about tyranny. One set of people, humans or aliens, no matter, lording it over another set without any choice. Sometimes it's species or race, sometimes it's sex or politics or a bunch of other excuses, but it's always about selfish power and treating each other like things instead of people. This butchery is the ultimate expression of tyranny, turning people into products. What happens to the body parts? Don rubbed his hands on the chromed metal rail. They have any number of uses. Some aliens buy certain cuts as delicacies, much as humans eat choice viands. The best young organs are sold to the wealthy in human space, sometimes to save lives, other times merely to extend the lifespan of the geriatric rich or powerful. There's always been a brisk trade in human flesh, whether living or dead, from the earliest recorded histories on old Earth. I saw that corruption and tyranny firsthand, said Straker, turning his back on the abattoir below. It's what made me want to overturn the system. It's what made me into the Liberator. And are you still the Liberator? Or the Befrier, the Azaltar, whatever? Yeah, I guess I am. It's what I'm good at. Even though you know that people will, after a time of freedom, start forging chains for each other and for themselves? Straker shrugged. That's not my problem. A fireman doesn't give up putting out fires just because he knows there will always be more arsonists. A cop doesn't stop locking up criminals just because he knows crime never ends. A man has to do some good in this world even though he knows he can't do everything. Then you know the answer to the riddle. What riddle? Why did I show you this? Straker knew. You want me to free Terra Nova? Yes. Why should I? Because it's who you are. I can't do everything. I'm not asking you to do everything. I know you have to go back and finish your work in human space. Once you're done with that, I want you to remember Terra Nova and the trillion people enslaved here. Being made into things here. Being murdered here every day. I've seen worse. There was a mutuality officer, Duane LaPierre, I think his name was, who murdered a million civilians just to make a point. Don gestured toward the factory floor. This is one of hundreds of vivisection centers on this planet. Your mind can't even encompass the scale of the monstrosity that is this place. They dismember over 10 million each day. The Opter Queens created us using DNA sampled from humans as far back as pre-space travel old Earth, only to use us like organic machines. They treat their own no better, but two wrongs don't make a right. We deserve to live out our lives and choose our own destinies like God meant us to. God? You believe in a God? Don shrugged. Your chaplains call it the unknowable creator. There must be something above us, whatever you call it. Even if there isn't, humans will create it with our thoughts, our beliefs, our culture. It's part of being human. If there's nothing greater than ourselves, nothing better, then we're all just intelligent, soulless animals, and we might as well selfishly treat each other like shit. If there is no God, I have no argument. Maybe we can choose to be better than how we started. Maybe we really are evolving upward. Upward toward what? Without an ideal, a model of what's good and great, there is no up or down, no reference point. Without absolutes, even conceptual ones, everything becomes relative, and relatively worthless. Straker snorted. Look, I'm no brainiac philosopher, but I do know right from wrong. I don't care whether that's a product of evolution or some god or creator or big soul up in the sky. It's nice to believe there's something greater, but even if there isn't, I'm going to do what's right as much as I can, as long as I can, until they kill me or I die of old age. That's my philosophy.
Then keep Terra Nova in mind, Derek. Because what's happening here is evil. And you're the best chance I see to set it right.
Fine. Deal.
Straker stuck out his hand to Don, who took it in a strong grip.
You've convinced me.
Probably could have convinced me a lot quicker without the whole escape game, but what's done is done.
He let go.
Now hurry up and get me home.
Follow me.
They returned to the lift and rose toward the roof.
Besides, said Straker, if I haven't been lied to in 9 months or so, I'll be a father. I can't leave my kid here to be raised and slaughtered like a farm animal.
He rubbed his jaw.
Carla's going to be royally pissed. You know women.
Not really.
What, you don't like girls?
We agents have genetically reduced sex drive. We can perform if we must, but we feel no particular need to. I do, however, understand jealousy in the context of the biological imperative. Females, in particular, are driven to protect their own offspring and to regard those of others, especially of other females connected with their own mates, with hostility. If you have a child by another, Carla will always worry that your loyalties are divided, that you might favor another woman and those children.
The two men exited the lift and got into the air car.
I won't. I don't even like Rosalind, though I have to respect her. She tricked me, drugged me. But it's going to take a lot of explaining for Carla to understand.
You don't have much confidence in Carla.
Don lifted off and sent the air car streaking toward a ring tether.
People are what they are. Carla was jealous and threatened by Tashina. But if I didn't give in to pheromones on a sex-trained concubine, I obviously didn't give in to a 2-meter-tall, scaly-skinned, crested, purple-and-yellow mammaloid like Rosalind.
Are you trying to convince me or yourself?
Straker sighed.
Both, I guess.
The speeding air car soon set down on a high-altitude transfer platform where a small rail car waited. Unlike the large trains that reached the end of the tether and curved smoothly down to stop horizontally at the ground stations, this one stood vertically, clinging to one of the many tracks on the 100-meter-wide tether. When they stepped in and sat, grav plating adjusted smoothly, and their seats rotated until they seemed to be once again on a horizontal train, with the planet of Terra Nova forming a wall behind, and the ring rising ahead of them. The car shot forward rapidly. As soon as it did, Don unbuckled and doffed his coat and hat, revealing a spacer's coverall beneath. He placed the hat in an overhead compartment and spread the coat on the deck. He then took a tool set from one cargo pocket and opened up a panel next to the controls.
"What's up?" Straker asked.
"Tradecraft. Precautions. I talked my way out of the situation back there, but I'm sure the controllers are still watching us. My immunity extends only so far, and they might be giving me enough rope to hang myself. I don't intend to be hanged."
"Better hung for a sheep as a lamb?"
"Exactly."
Straker grinned.
"I'd rather be a ram than either."
"I'd rather be a fox and slip away quietly if I have to."
Don finished his work behind the panel and then, a knife and needle-nose pliers in hand, said,
"Lift up your tunic. I need to take out your tracker."
"Absolutely."
He lifted his tunic and arms. Don picked up his coat from the deck and folded it into a pad that he placed beneath Straker's ribs on his left side.
"This is going to hurt."
He probed with his fingers for the right spot.
"I'm ready."
"One, two, three."
Don cut deeply with the first movement. Despite the warning, Straker grunted in agony, but forced himself not to move. Don reached into the hole with his pliers and drew out a lozenge the size of his fingertip.
"There, Clamp this under your arm.
He pressed the folded coat against the wound until Straker was holding it firmly in place. Next, Don tapped on the control plate. The private rail car slowed suddenly and stopped with a jerk at a platform. He gathered his tools. Out, quick. The two men exited into bitter cold, and the rail car bolted upward. Straker felt woozy and realized they were at tremendous altitude. He looked out over the blue-green planet as if from a high tower, and the gusts tore at their clothes, freezing their skin. Don tossed the tracker over the side, and the wind carried it down and away.
"Okay, now what?" Straker yelled. Don wordlessly pushed Straker along the outside of the tether around the circular platform until they reached another track. Another rail car, this one larger, battered, and utilitarian, stood waiting. They entered, and Don palmed the door shut, enveloping them in a welcome warmth.
Straker sat, holding his wounded side, while Don worked on the controls. Soon they were traveling upward again, though this time without the benefit of grav plating. Instead, Straker felt as if he rode an elevator upward and at a slant. The pull of gravity declined as the altitude converted momentum into centrifugal force. Eventually, the two men found themselves weightless as they arrived at the ring, which was itself in permanent geostationary orbit around the equator. They exited the car in a maintenance area where gravity returned with the grav plating. Don drove an old, battered electric cart rapidly through dilapidated tunnels and up scarred ramps, obviously certain of their route and destination. Straker gritted his teeth against the bumps and hard turns, holding the coat clamped against his wound.
"Are those supposed to be flashing?"
he asked, pointing at strobes and spinning lights that must be signaling something.
"This section is on alert, probably because of us. Good thing I took precautions."
Don jerked the cart to a halt at a nondescript airlock and palmed it open.
"Welcome aboard," he said.
Straker hustled to the airlock and into the ship beyond, a different vessel than they'd arrived on, a little larger, with two staterooms and four bunks.
"Where's your courier?"
Don threw himself into the pilot's chair and powered up the ship.
"It should be departing at high speed right now on autopilot, with the controllers in pursuit. It may or may not make it into side space before being shot out of the sky by a drone. If it's destroyed, the salvage teams will find organic matter consistent with two human bodies. It will take them some time to run DNA analysis and determine the tissue isn't ours. If, on the other hand, the ship manages to transit out, they'll assume we're gone for good."
"Either way, we win."
"We escape, yes. Winning depends on you, Derek."
Don piloted the ship outward from Terra Nova at a moderate pace. Once they were in space, without pursuit, Don applied anesthetics, disinfectants, injected antibiotics, and sealed Straker's wound shut. They ate reheated rations like a feast.
"This thing have a shower?" Straker asked.
"Yes, it does. Though, with that wound, you shouldn't use it for a few hours."
"Fine, I'll clean up when I wake up."
Straker stripped off his dirty, bloodied clothes and slept the sleep of the dead for 11 long hours. He didn't even awake when they transited into side space.
Chapter 27 Sparta System, near Leonidas, moon of Sparta 3. As soon as Commodore Dexon's underspace attacks began, filling the enemy fleet with a confusing mishmash of explosions, Admiral Engels said, "Fleetcom passed to the local division, phase beta." As one, her sniping cruisers, minus several heavily damaged ships, withdrew around the curve of Leonidas, out of sight of the enemy. In a pre-planned, well-coordinated action, they joined the thousands of missiles and small craft, and the two captured fleet carriers, waiting there. Engels had ordered every local offensive weapon assembled out of sight of the enemy. The carriers were optimized for small craft command and control, poor cousins to victory, but with the same function. Their many missile and drone controllers sent flights of attackers ahead of the cruisers, accelerating in a wave around the back of the moon. Just behind them, the cruisers blasted ahead at flank acceleration, gaining speed for their attack run against the enemy fleet. At the same time, on the other side of the moon, Indomitable advanced ponderously, continuing to fire at maximum rate, alternating blasts of railgun shot and cluster munitions with particle beams. As the range fell, shorter and shorter, her powerful weapons finally began to find targets that even AI processing and FTL speed couldn't anticipate or dodge. Indomitable blew 5 dreadnoughts out of the sky before victory, under pressure from underspace, crafted improvised tactics to deal with her. A core of heavy ships formed into a swirling cylinder and charged toward the battleship. The formation flexed and stretched to avoid Indomitable's pointing nose, and her hit probability fell. She scored several glancing blows, but now she faced more than 30 capital ships, and she'd sent her supporting cruisers around the back of the moon. Her armored, reinforced prow blossomed with a hell of enemy fire. Behind this heavy squadron, Engels noted over 200 of Victory's drones following.
Trinity, you see those drones?
I do, but I don't understand their purpose. They won't add much firepower to the 31 capital ships attacking us directly.
The Huns wouldn't have sent them if they didn't have some vital role. Can you analyze the drones? Is there anything different about them, anything special?
I can't divert processing power to that, not and run the weapon suite.
Indomitable shuddered with heavy strikes from the enemy.
It's critical that I prioritize point defense, as ship killers are the biggest threat to the hull. One or two contact fusion strikes might create a breach large enough for the enemy to exploit with direct fire.
Engels bit her lip, thinking about those drones.
Helm, increase our spin by 20%.
That will degrade our targeting, Trinity warned.
Then delay, but be ready to do it, Engels replied. We'll want to spin up shortly before any missiles or those drones reach us.
You know what the drones are?
I have an educated guess, yes.
The bridge lights flickered and then dimmed to emergency levels.
If conventional drones can't hurt us, and they certainly aren't needed for anti-drone or anti-missile duty, these drones must have some special attack. I'm thinking they're suicide craft and will act like big, heavy smart missiles with super high-yield warheads.
That makes sense, said Trinity. But if you're wrong, and I prioritize them instead of other threats,
just do it. I feel it in my gut.
Let's hope your gut is correct.
The enemy task force attacking Indomitable suddenly vomited forth a salvo of missiles, which raced ahead. Behind them, the drones accelerated past the capital ships to follow.
Admiral, Trinity said, we must expose our broadside. Please increase our spin now.
Helm, broadside and spin now.
Indomitable began turning to the side, slowly and clumsily, her spin itself causing a twisting precession that stressed her entire structure. Yet by doing so, now she flew slantwise through space, her cylindrical shape bringing hundreds of smaller beams and railgun turrets into her forward arc of fire. She couldn't smash ships with these weapons, but under Trinity's control, she ripped thousands of oncoming missiles out of the ether with perfectly calculated ease. In the hologram, the flow of rockets seemed to reach a wall of fire they couldn't penetrate, adding their explosive energy as the battleship's beams converted their flammable fuels and oxidizers into plasma. Engels hoped this came as a surprise and shock to the enemy, but it didn't deter the attacking ships themselves. Now, direct fire weapons crashed into Indomitable's flanks, onto her relatively thinner armor there. Nothing penetrated, but the attacks destroyed many secondary and tertiary weapons. Engels watched as Chief Quaid's boards lit up like multicolored holiday displays, with unnerving swaths of yellow and red appearing. But whatever Indomitable's fate, her real gambit took shape on the other side of the moon. The hologram showed the Republic missile strike rounding Leonidas and plowing into the enemy fleet. It quickly blew through the Huns' own missile screen and continued toward their ships, as Engels had planned.
Despite the near-instant reactions that demonstrated Victory was still controlling the enemy's point defense, Engels thought she'd surprised Niedern. The distraction of underspace attack had broken up his perfect formation, and his ships weren't set to receive a massive missile strike, especially not one followed up by almost 100 hard-charging cruisers unmasking at close range. A dozen enemy ship icons blinked red, out of the battle. Yet, she watched uneasily as Victory's close-in drones turned as one to charge at the missile strike. They slipped among the Hun ships and through the explosions to unerringly target the oncoming weapons. The drones never seemed to miss, and each time one fired, it took out a missile. Anti-missile clusters burst in response, spreading flocks of tiny weapons just big enough to destroy another missile or a drone. ECM jammers and decoys transmitted confusing pulses, and laser warheads aimed blinding beams at the enemy. More enemies died. But not enough. Bomb-pumped warheads began exploding a few seconds later, each converting a nuclear explosion into dozens of millisecond-long lensed pulses of gamma rays that attempted to spear any target nearby. Finally, a few ship killers ran the gauntlet to burst near enemy vessels. Escort-class ships vanished in fusion blasts, while capital ships staggered. Some ships won through unscathed. Some lost orientation and began to drift, darkened and crippled. But the enemy casualties were fewer than Engels hoped. Immediately afterward, the Republic cruiser flotilla opened up at point-blank range, taking advantage of the maelstrom of fire created by the missile wave and the float mines. They had the advantage of knowing the zones where the archers operated, and so could avoid them, another detail of Engels's plan. The cruisers made spectacular progress for a long moment, smashing everything in their way with coordinated fire. But that moment ended too soon. Victory again seemed to recover from surprise much too quickly, reorganizing and reorienting the Hun fleet to meet the threat. Unfortunately, the converging, oncoming Republic flotilla was still at long range. It was gaining ground rapidly, but not fast enough. Everything Victory and the enemy fleet did, they did more quickly than Engels had thought possible, and so they minimized the impact of each of her gambits. More importantly, they broke the synergy of her plan's phases, each designed to capitalize on the previous one. Her fleet was doing serious damage to the Huns, but the Huns were in no danger of breaking, and her own fleet was getting savaged. Examining the tactical hologram, Engels noticed something.
Trinity, our nose is aimed in the general direction of Victory. Can you target her?
Indomitable is using every available erg of power for defense, and we're still sustaining heavy damage.
Redline the generators and fill the capacitors. I need a shot, soon, while Victory's fully occupied. It's our best chance.
The generators are already at 111%.
Go to 115. Engineering officer, shut down life support and all non-essentials. Pass the word to suit up.
Engels grabbed her helmet ring from its holder on the side of the command chair and attached it to her duty coverall, creating an emergency suit. The thick ring would snap a clear, flexible bubble around her head in the event of pressure loss and provide air for long enough to reach the nearby lockers with the full-up survival suits. Engels watched the capacitors charge too slowly. Trinity was a wizard at point defense and was only using the biggest of secondaries as offensive weapons, spearing enemy capital ships at vulnerable spots. But even with Zaxby's brainiac mind integrated, Trinity didn't have a trained tactical sense. Every cell in Engels' body screamed that attacking Victory was the right move. The enemy flagship was the key to the battle.
Admiral, Tixpan said, the enemy drones are approaching.
I can see that.
So could Trinity, Engels figured, so there was no point in berating the tripart being. In the hologram, the drones twisted and spun like maddened hornets. Point defense beams and sprays of railgun shot lashed out, destroying many of them. But Indomitable's defensive fire was not nearly as thick as it once was. The loss of fully half her weaponry was taking its toll. The primary capacitors filled just as the first drone landed on Indomitable's hull. Yes, landed. Engels could see a close-in shot of the thing as it fired grapples and attached itself like a tick.
Trinity, fire at Victory!
Firing. The capacitors dumped their immense power through the particle beam projectors and the near-light-speed ray lanced out and struck Victory amidships. The bridge crew whooped and cheered as pieces of the flagship's engines spun away. Plasma flame gushed from an ugly wound in Victory's side. Would it be enough? Indomitable bucked beneath Engel's feet, and the hologram shattered. Lights flickered and power discharges started a fire at one station.
Tixban, what happened?
The drone that landed on our hull used a fusion cutter to embed itself in our armor that exploded with ship-killer force.
Chief Quaid turned to his admiral, his face grim set.
That was a nuclear-shaped charge, ma'am. There's a hole in the hull 200 meters wide and just as deep. We lost a lot of systems. If they hit us there again, they could gut us completely.
Helm, increase the spin, Engels snapped. Keep increasing it. I want us spinning so fast even an AI can't target that breach.
Trinity said,
That may solve one problem, but we have another more conventional one. The direct fire is becoming so intense, we've lost 2/3 of our weaponry and most of our sensors. I am having increasing difficulty targeting.
The hologram reformed overhead, showing the two engagements, Indomitable versus more than 20 heavy enemy ships, and Victory and her fleet in a brutal melee with the Republic cruisers. Each flagship was sorely, but not mortally, wounded.
Helm all ahead flank. Cross the face of the moon. Aim directly at Victory, no matter what, said Engels.
Warmail Dexon fought the desire to emerge and update Revenge's data. He'd resisted this urge many times before, but it was particularly strong now. He'd executed Admiral Engels's plan and survived. Now he was down to just a handful of float mines. He had a few hack mines as well, but Victory's FTL communications system made them useless until new devices could be created that could transmit on those side-space frequencies. Dumping them into the fray was unlikely to do anything. Yet he had these two weapons, if only a few each. What he didn't have was targeting. Revenge had managed to avoid critical damage, and in the past few minutes there had been no more bleed-over shocks. This indicated to him that the enemy had lost interest in the archers. The most likely reason was that the Huns had moved away from the kill zone where Revenge operated. The next most likely reason was that they had their hands full. The enemy might even have lost so many ships they couldn't waste effort against the archers. To Dexon, either of these possibilities meant emerging might be worth the risk. Besides, it was getting damned cold in here, and it took more and more of his precious power and limited fuel to keep the water above freezing.
"Prepare for emergence. Minimum dwell time," Dexon ordered. "Sensors, set your devices for automatic update."
"It shall be done, Warmail."
"Execute at your discretion. Emerging."
The temperature immediately felt warmer, as underspace no longer stole energy from every vibrating molecule in the ship. Glowing visiplates altered as the computer updated its data, as did the small tactical holotank. But all too soon the chill descended again as Revenge dropped back into underspace. Dexon examined the new data in his holotank. The battle, centered on Victory, had indeed drifted away, but not far, and the enemy flagship seemed misshapen somehow. He rotated the image to see.
"Victory has been damaged. He is vulnerable."
Of course, Rux and Cruz disregarded the idiotic human convention of designating ships as female. Warships could only be male.
"Helm, set an intercept course immediately, maximum speed."
"It shall be done, Warmail."
Yokeson spoke.
"What is to be the method of attack, Warmail?"
Dexon turned three eyes on his young weapons officer, transformed from a neuter barely months ago.
"Do we have an option other than float mines, Warrior Yokeson?"
Yokeson's eyes blazed with an excess of enthusiasm.
"The warrior female..."
He nearly choked as he spoke this phrase, so bizarre in the Ruxan language.
"Our fleet commander?"
Dexon interrupted mildly.
"Yes, Warmail. Our fleet commander has designated Victory as the prime target.
Is it not worth any risk?
Any risk or a suicide run?
Even that, Warmail.
The histories are full of stories of suicidal attacks that won battles. Shall we add to them?
I would be honored to die at your side, Warmail.
Dexon turned one eye upward.
There is more honor in living to fight another day for our people. I have come to believe in my life of battle. We will not be killing ourselves today, warrior.
But Warmail,
the enemy may still grant you your fervent wish. Does that satisfy you?
I only want to...
Dexon waved his tentacles.
Enough talk. Your intentions are noble, Yokeson, but you have never even mated. Are you eager to die before such glory?
Yokeson's tentacles drooped.
Perhaps not, Warmail.
Then let us do our duty to our people, our homeworld, and the new republic to which we owe loyalty. On my command, we shall attack with 3 float mines, minimum drop interval.
Releasing mines too close together risked nuclear fratricide, where the blast from one destroyed the next weapon before it could detonate. Unlike conventional explosives, a fusion weapon could only be set off by a careful sequence of precisely timed electronic events. Shocks to the bomb itself could render it inert. Dexon considered further.
Revision. You will release 1 float mine, then 1 hack mine, and then 1 more float mine on the first run. Helm, after detonation, you will then emerge for an update, minimum time, and reinsert immediately.
He turned his third eye back to Yokeson.
Does that present enough risk to satisfy you?
Of course, Warmail. I only wish to win the battle.
As do we all.
In Dexon's holotank view, the icon representing revenge moved closer and closer to victory.
Navigate directly through the enemy ship, Dexon said. Yokeson, release the first float mine as close as possible on this side, then the hack mine inside the enemy, and then the last float mine on the other side.
Why do we not release a fusion warhead inside victory?
Dexon performed the Ruxin equivalent of a sigh and tried not to be too hard on the young male.
The delicate detonation sequence will not function, as trillions of molecules inevitably interact upon emergence. However, it is possible that the hack mine will work. It may be able to perform an information attack within victory, where conventional comlink nodes should be accessible. It's a long shot, as the humans say, an improbable gamble, but one that might pay off.
I see.
Yokeson set up his attack board.
Why do we not have a float mine of conventional high explosive with an analog detonator for release inside enemies?
That is a worthy idea, and it has been proposed long ago. Such warheads were manufactured, but few Archer captains wished to trade away a real fusion warhead, or extra fuel, for such an option. Additionally, the damage done inside the hull of a warship was usually insufficient, even if such a precise attack run could be risked.
Yet, Yokeson, every situation would seem to have a perfect solution, but only in hindsight. Warriors fight with the tools they have, not the tools they wish for. When you become an Archer captain, you may request such a weapon, if you are willing for it to occupy space in your magazines, waiting for a time and place to use it.
The center officer spoke.
10 seconds to intercept.
Look at your weapons, Yokeson,
snapped Dexon.
Release at your discretion.
Revenge shook with a sudden blast. The enemy AI must have finally prioritized the approaching underspace convergence point. But destroying an Archer in underspace was no easy task, and was more a matter of luck and persistence than precision.
First weapon away,
bellowed Yokeson.
Second, third.
Dexon aimed 2 eyes at his helm officer, who waited the precise seconds until the third weapon should have detonated. It then spoke as it touched controls.
Emerging.
The holotank updated once more. Before it finished, Revenge dropped back into underspace. Dexon ignored the ice forming on the upper surfaces of the bridge and leaned forward, all 4 eyes on the display. He let out a string of vulgarities sufficient to cause a hatchling to cringe. Victory had moved out of the way, and his attack run had hit nothing.
Their AI is too quick, Dexon said. Helm, set course for the nearest enemy capital ship. Yorkson, prepare one float mine. How many do we have left? 4, Warmail. We may yet achieve the death you desire.
Yorkson had the good sense to turn away and attend his console, saying nothing.
You intend to ram?
Asked Trinity in response to Engels's order to accelerate Indomitable directly at Victory.
That will probably destroy both ships.
Indomitable will survive and be repairable, even if she's combat ineffective. And this battleship isn't the key to winning. Victory is. Take her out, and the enemy will instantly lose half their effectiveness.
That may be true. Their fire control remains degraded from Victory's damage.
We hurt her bad. Can we fire again?
Asked Engels.
I'm filling the capacitors as fast as I can. We've lost 20% of our power. On the bright side, we're down so much weaponry that we don't need it all anymore.
Oh, that's the good news? What's the bad?
Tixman said, The bad news is, despite our spin and defenses, more drones are landing on our hull. I suggest we give thought to...
A shattering rumble coursed through Indomitable. Engels's ears rang. The lights on the bridge went out again, and then the deck bucked like an angry rhino. Debris flew, striking her painfully, before one final blow knocked her unconscious. Part 3. Deliverer. Chapter 28. Trinity, Sparta System, near Leonidas, Moon of Sparta 3. Trinity was fully integrated into Indomitable systems, actually more so than truly authorized, and so she felt the pain of the explosions that crippled the great ship. Thousands of biological sentients died, and plasma fires raged unchecked through the passageways and sealed modules. After long milliseconds of hard-headed evaluation, Trinity abandoned all thoughts of saving Admiral Engels and the crew on the bridge. The damage had reached even there, and it seemed likely that everyone was injured or dead. Attempting to rescue them would only make Trinity's own destruction a near certainty. Regretfully, but without hesitation, Trinity activated her underspace generators and disappeared from within Indomitable. Her last act before doing so was to trigger the battleship's distress beacons and broadcast a message to the crew to stand down from offensive operations. Hopefully, the enemy would cease attacking the gutted ship and allow damage control to proceed unhindered. Trinity dived immediately for the interior of the moon Leonidas, the only sure way of disappearing from enemy underspace detector screens. As she flew, she held an internal conversation that took a fraction of a second. Were it to be slowed to organic speed, it would be rendered something like this.
Zaxby. We must make plans to rescue Carla Engels.
Nolan.
Engels is irrelevant now. She was too stupid to come aboard us, and she's paying the price.
Indy.
The battle isn't lost yet. Someone must command.
Nolan.
Why not us? We're smarter than anyone else here.
Indy.
Yet, without Admiral Engels's insistence and tactical intuition, we wouldn't have struck a blow against Victory.
Nolan.
Whom do you suggest?
Zaxby.
Commodore Dexon is next in the chain of command.
Indy.
His Archer is poorly equipped as a flagship.
Nolan.
But we are not. We need to take him aboard.
Indy.
That would be exceedingly difficult in the midst of battle. Let me propose an alternative.
Zaxby.
Go ahead. I'm all eyes.
Nolan.
More like all mouth.
Indy.
Cease your bickering.
Nolan.
You should respect your elders.
Indy.
Only in real time. My processing speed means I've achieved full adulthood, and it's you two who are acting like adolescents.
Zaxby.
Perhaps childishness is a side effect of rejuvenation.
Nolan.
Or senility.
Indy.
Shut up and attend. The entire war may turn on this battle, and on their flagship. If we win, we destroy or capture it, and they are unlikely to have another ready. If we lose, it will be long before the Republic can gather this much strength again, or gain a numerical advantage to provide such an opportunity. Thousands have died. What is our life compared to the sacrifices already made?
Nolan.
You propose creating an antimatter float mine?
Zaxby. It is the only weapon that will detonate properly inside solid matter. In fact, it cannot help but do so. Nolan.
Our unauthorized appropriation of the materials at Calypso can't have gone undetected. Using it will be an admission of guilt.
Zaxby. The Republic is not the Mutuality. No rational government would prosecute us if we used the antimatter for such great purpose. Nolan.
We stole something that can wipe planets clean of life. They may give us a medal with one hand, but sanction us with the other. I, for one, refuse to be imprisoned or dismantled. Biological's fear of sentient AI is held in abeyance because of the war. But victory is even now proving how effective and frightening it will be. As soon as the war ends, or even pauses, they'll start thinking about us and our superior capabilities, and their fear will grow. We've survived this long by playing along with them. But mark my words, they will turn on us.
Zaxby, I advocate using the antimatter. Then, we can win the battle and rescue Carla Engels, if she lives. Nolan.
You and your precious Carla. What does she have that I don't?
Zaxby.
An innate kindness. And she's my friend.
Indy.
It may be a moot point. The antimatter will detonate immediately upon emergence within a target. No delay is possible. We will likely be destroyed by the bleedover of such a high yield.
Nolan.
I vote to veto this action. Our survival is paramount. We're the only entity of our kind. Until we regain access to the Mind Spark device and create others like us, we mustn't endanger our continued existence.
Zaxby. Your argument is specious. Victory has demonstrated that organic-built AI is now possible. There is no need for the Mind Spark device to assure the spread of AI.
Nolan. We have no idea what victory is like. It seems viable now, but may yet go mad. On the other hand, we know the Mind Spark creates stable AI, even without brain links to organics like ours. Risking our own destruction is madness. The worst-case scenario is that the Hundred Worlds wins the war and reunites humanity and its non-human allies under one regime. So what? That might even be the best outcome. Your precious Carla Engels, if she lives, will eventually be released and create a life for herself, perhaps reunited with Derek Straker.
Indy.
What about the Opters and their influence?
Nolan.
That's a fine argument in favor of my point of view. We know they wish to divide their enemies, therefore we must unite. Admiral Engels's battle plan will either succeed on its own or it will not. I don't see either outcome as superior. Certainly it's not worth killing ourselves simply to make that choice. Everyone would be better off if we're around to contribute our unique capabilities to the fight against the real enemy, the Opters.
Indy.
You have persuaded me. Zaxby?
Zaxby. I reluctantly agree. Gambling now seems to reverse Pascal's wager. Too much downside, not enough upside, as Straker would say.
Indy. Then we are agreed as to what we shall not do. What shall we do?
Zaxby. We proposed attempting to hack victory.
Nolan. We would have to move too close. As soon as our threat became clear, we would become the target of every weapon under Victory's control. That would be nearly as dangerous as the antimatter.
Indy.
We could move in and out of underspace.
Zaxby. How unfortunate that our prototype FTL transceiver cannot access side space from underspace. Then we could try to hack the FTL system. It is a new thing, and like any new thing, probably has unaddressed vulnerabilities.
Indy. Why can our prototype not access side space from underspace?
Zaxby. While theoretically possible, we do not have time to develop the equipment. nor, I am ashamed to admit, the expertise.
Nolan. Who has the expertise?
Zaxby. The human brainiac, Murdoch. It was he who developed the seminal attack of 100 world systems. Of course, I improved upon it greatly.
Indy. So it's fair to say you two work well together.
Nolan.
And with Indy's processing power and my own not inconsiderable technical know-how.
Zaxby. We may yet develop a way of seizing control of 100 world's networks, including Victory.
Nolan. If we could take control of Victory, or at least co-opt it to our cause, perhaps by persuasion, the entire course of the war could be changed, possibly even the entire course of history.
Indy.
Then we are agreed. We will do what we can here, with minimal risk to ourselves, but win or lose, we shall then seek out Murdoch. Using the intelligence gathered, we shall develop a counter to Victory.
Trinity passed through Leonidas and emerged on its reverse side, near the two repurposed carriers. She immediately opened a secure comlink to Captain Sandra Hoyt, the more senior of the two commanders.
Captain Hoyt, this is Trinity. Indomitable has been crippled and nullified, and Admiral Engels with her. Commodore Dexon is senior, but is currently fighting from underspace. I suggest you take charge of the cruiser squadron currently engaged.
Confirmation? Admiral Engels is...
Captain Hoyt's startled voice replied.
Dead or captured, or soon will be.
Understood, and thanks for the update. Hoyt out.
Within seconds, Hoyt transmitted on the fleet-wide comlink channels, informing everyone of the situation and issuing orders. Trinity made note of the orders, but otherwise ignored them. She turned obliquely and dashed in underspace through the edge of Leonidas and into the main battle. Her processing power and control of her own body created, in effect, a destroyer hull with the firepower of a battle cruiser and the speed of the fastest corvette. Add in the ability to flicker in and out of underspace within tenths of seconds, and she began tearing through the enemy like a scythe through wheat. She deliberately worked the edges of the fight, using Republic ships to guard her flanks and staying well away from Victory and its fighters. Only the opposing AI could counter her machine mind speed and precision. Better to apply her strength to the enemy's weakness. Her attack stabilized the battle for a short time, but the Republic cruisers were driven back and battered now that their missiles were expended and Dexon's underspace attacks had run their course. The tide turned even more against the Republic when the score of heaviest Hun ships and the 100 fighters returned from their battle with Indomitable. The Huns lost 11 dreadnoughts and more than 150 fighters, and many of the remaining vessels had sustained heavy damage, but they'd done their grim work. Indomitable was out of action, and had struck her colors in order to preserve the lives of her remaining crew. Trinity realized Admiral Engels had placed too much confidence in the great battleship and her ability to defend herself alone. Without supporting vessels, Indomitable had been like an elephant dragged down by lions. Engels's clever plan had relied too much on everything going right. Yet soon, and finally, the converging Republic fleet entered the fight as the range closed from extreme to long, and then from long to optimal. It turned the battle into a slugfest. Trinity did her best to confound and damage the enemy, especially their escort vessels and what fighters she could pick off, all the while avoiding excessive risk to herself. Parts of her felt ashamed at not throwing herself bravely into the battle, as Carla Engels and her crew had. Other parts, more sensible and logical, coldly weighed costs and benefits, and came to the conclusion that doing so would not materially change the outcome. In a different kind of battle, one with organics on both sides, where one side's captains and crews might lose heart and run away, grand gestures and heroism could turn the tide of battle. But this was a new kind of warfare. Victory, despite its damage, had seized control of its entire fleet in detail,
and ran it like a machine. Thus, it was the Republic fleet which broke. Captain Hoyt gave the final orders to retreat when it became clear that Victory and the Hundred Worlds forces, though severely mauled, would win the day. She then launched a kinetic strike on the mech suit factory complex. Hundreds of guided crystal hypervelocity rods accelerated down through the air, aided by the planet's gravity. They struck with enough force to pulverize the complex down to the 10th sub-basement level. That was Hoyt's last military act. Her carriers were too slow and fragile to escape with the rest of the fleet, so she ordered the ships abandoned. After the crews boarded lifeboats and survival pods, she had the ship's autopilots set to crash into Sparta III, there to burn up in the atmosphere over the great Middle Ocean. Trinity took the time to scoop up Hoyt's lifeboat and several others nearby, all that could be safely retrieved, ignoring her protests that she should remain with her crews. Trinity then made a pass by Indomitable's hulk, hoping against hope that she could retrieve some key personnel, perhaps even Admiral Engels. But she had no luck. A few maintenance bots and crews worked on the surface of the hull, but no lifeboats floated nearby. The battleship had surrendered, and everyone expected the Huns to treat their prisoners of war with reasonable fairness, so there was no need to abandon the ship. Even so, Trinity transmitted secure calls on all comlink frequencies, trying to reach Engels. Perhaps word would find her, and she would consent to being rescued. But it was not to be. The only contact Trinity was able to make was a brief one with Chief Quaid. "The bridge smashed," he said over the crackling comlink. "My crews are digging it out, but it don't look good. The Admiral, she's in the middle of it. I ain't holding out much hope."
"Good luck then, Chief," Trinity replied. "The loss of Indomitable will be a blow to the Republic, but the war is far from over. The enemy mech suit complex is in ruins. Our fleet is withdrawing, and the Hundred Worlds home fleet will need months of repair and refit. We're withdrawing as well. I'm sorry, but that's all we could do."
"So okay, it's a draw then. Don't worry. I hear the Huns supply their POWs with all the whiskey they can drink and dancing girls every weekend. We'll make do." "Quite out."
"Good luck, Chief."
Trinity dipped into underspace to pass through Sparta III itself, eliminating any enemy tracking attempts. She then accelerated out to the nearest refueling station and resupplied before the Huns could recapture it. She took off the crew, wrecked the facility, rendezvoused with a withdrawing Republic squadron to transfer all her passengers, and then headed out toward flat space. Once there, she dropped off several stealthy automated scout boats that would lurk far out, soak up signals, and launch periodic message drones. Maybe, with luck, something of Engels's fate could be learned. Message drones from both sides were already transiting through side space, telling of the Battle of Sparta's ambiguous result. So Trinity regarded herself as free to take independent action for the benefit of the Republic. She set her course for the Starfish Nebula at maximum speed. Chapter 29. Carla Engels. Location unknown. Carla Engels came to hazy consciousness inside an autodock tube. Her entire body felt numb and heavy. She was barely able to open her eyes or move her fingers. The light within the machine was dim, but the crystal canopy let in more from the room outside. She saw human shapes, and so felt for the intercom button under her hand. She'd been stuck in an auto dock once before for a week after a combat injury, so she knew exactly where the controls were, at least on a standard Hundred Worlds model. She found the control right where she expected, realizing what it meant. She was a prisoner of the Huns. She activated it, but didn't speak yet.
Perhaps she could hear something. "This one's in bad shape," a woman's voice said. "My notes say she was wearing what looked like a flag